This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Tonight, are you wearing a mask against the coronavirus? Well, health authorities say you just don't need to. It's a waste. We'll tell you why. Coronavirus panic, meanwhile, grips the stock markets. Money is rushing out with no sign of an end.
Look, I'm not going to lie, at this stage it could get worse. I think it's all going to be about how quickly we can contain the spread of this virus, whether we see this contagion in the US and Europe really pick up. This has the capacity to spiral out of control.
And a new watchdog, not judges, is proposed to decide on any future raids on journalists. That and so much more for you on PM. Well, if you've been worrying about the rolling COVID-19 virus crisis and you've raced to the shops and you've bought and started wearing those face masks, well, Australian health authorities say don't do it. You are wasting them. You don't need to wear a face mask out of fear of the coronavirus, they say. The plea comes after the government activated its coronavirus emergency response plan yesterday. Madeline Jenner reports.
On the streets of Sydney, it can be hard to get your hands on a face mask.
We haven't got face masks since 2 months. It's out of stock from supplier. We tried so many suppliers, but we don't have it.
This pharmacy still has hand sanitizer, but that's selling fast too.
We got yesterday 48. Now it's only 17 or 18 left within even not 24 hours.
The federal government has activated its emergency response plan, but today authorities are urging people not to use face masks. Chief Medical Officer Brendan Murphy.
Whilst we are preparing and we are realistic about what might come in future weeks, we are not in a situation where anyone needs to be concerned. No one should go around wearing and wasting face masks, please.
The Australian government has around 20 million face masks stockpiled, and this morning Health Minister Greg Hunt met the state and territories to discuss the virus. High on the agenda was how to get supplies where they are needed, if they are needed. Jenny Makarkos is the Victorian Health Minister.
A lot of our supply chain, our supplies are actually from overseas. As demand grows internationally and perhaps some supplies in China might be impacted by their own local manufacturing been shut down, we need to be innovative, we need to be nimble. So Greg and I have been having discussions around local manufacturers here in Victoria that might be able to scale up their production.
The COAG meeting also focused on the impact a pandemic might have on the aged care sector. Federal Health Minister Greg Hunt.
The last figures that I saw is that the median age for loss of life was about 71 and a half. And that means those that are elderly, and in particular those that have difficulties with immune system are most at risk, and that's why that's our absolute top priority.
And the Prime Minister has again today urged Australians not to panic. He says no country is better prepared than Australia. Josh Davis is the President of the Australasian Society for Infectious Diseases.
Yeah, look, I think that's a bit of a difficult to prove claim that no country is as well prepared as us. But I think Australia is well prepared, and I should emphasise that the responses thus far from the Australian government have been strong and effective.
And this outbreak is being used to push the case for Australia to have a centralised national coordinating centre to manage pandemics.
Well, firstly, it would be improved communication and coordination. So we've seen throughout the evolution of this coronavirus outbreak, conflicting advice from different states around things like infection control, quarantining, social distancing, school closures, all those sorts of things. And on any given week, depending on what state you're in, people have received different advice about that, which doesn't really make a lot of sense. A national coordinating body would have the authority and jurisdiction to just issue advice for the whole country. You know, if there's one good thing to come out of this coronavirus, it's increased awareness amongst the public of the importance of coordination of the country's response to infections.
Professor Raina McIntyre is the head of the biosecurity program at the Kirby Institute at the University of New South Wales. When it comes to a centralised centre for disease control, she's not holding her breath.
I've been working in public health for close to 30 years now in Australia, and it's been a debate that's been going on as long as I've been working in public health in Australia. And the problem is the political cycle is short. It leaves us with less capability for operational response at a federal level. There's a lot we do and can do at the federal level. But, for example, in the US or in the UK, there's actually people who can go out and do field work sent out into the field from the central kind of agency. It's also about surveillance and a whole lot of other things that, you know, a centrally coordinated agency would do.
Efforts are continuing to create a vaccine, with several groups across the globe stating that they could have a vaccine ready in 12 to 18 months. But Raina McIntyre says more work is also needed to improve the diagnostic tests to better identify sick people and halt the spread of the virus.
Madeline Jenner with that report. Well, while some are panic buying face masks, others are panic selling shares. The Australian Stock Exchange's benchmark ASX 200 index fell another 3.3% today and is now in a technical correction, meaning it has dropped more than 10% from its recent highs. Wall Street's Dow Jones Industrial Average experienced its biggest single-day points drop in history overnight, and it's not over yet, it seems. Watching this route all week for you has been our business reporter David Taylor.
We just looked at Southwest there, going in the stock market from 52-week high to 52-week low. This is not an airline that flies to China at all.
A US television journalist trying to make sense of this week's stock market falls in the world's biggest economy.
It's like everybody's being taken out and shot.
This market dive has taken just about every stock down with it. The speed of the decline over the past week beats the Black Monday plunge in October 1987. Eleanor Cray is the market strategist for Saxo Capital Markets. She explains the market's diving, but admittedly from a great height.
So now we've got this complete reversal in investor sentiment, whereby the equity market, which is supposed to be a forward-looking environment where investors price in uncertainties and risks, had been completely ignoring the risks and is now having to catch up to those risks. And so that's been that we've seen some quite heavy selling this week. We've seen a huge reversal in that optimistic sentiment, and the unwind has been quite violent.
How bad could it get?
Look, I'm not going to lie, at this stage it could get worse. I think it's all going to be about how quickly we can contain the spread of this virus, what the ongoing transmission is like, whether we see this contagion in the US and Europe really pick up, because at this stage it's really unknown. This has the capacity to spiral out of control.
So who does this share market correction affect, and how does it affect them? Andrew Page runs an online investment community, sharing war stories and ideas for how to invest. He explains the current market rout will affect individual Australians very differently, depending on how long they plan to stay in the market.
If you're a young person and you've got money in super, you're probably going to have money in super for decades to come. And over these coming decades, we're going to see all manner of share market crashes and corrections and economic hiccups and recessions. That's a given. It's a guarantee. We also know from history, though, that despite all of these things that have always happened and always will happen, it's been an incredibly great place for wealth creation.
And so, speaking of wealth creation, what about older Australians, those approaching retirement or in retirement? How will they physically be affected by what's happened today?
Well, their net worth is less than it was last week. Again, context is very important here. Despite this really brutal week we've had on the markets, we are still sitting only about 10% away from all-time record highs. So, you know, definitely poorer than you were last week. Chances are a lot wealthier than you were 5-10 years ago.
The key concern for everyone with skin in the game, says Eleanor Cray, is how long the virus threat will last and what governments and policymakers can do now to help contain the problem.
It's a thing where we've got this impending potential monetary stimulus from central banks, which is what investors have been banking on to date. It's something that they can't really fix, is that dent to demand, and they certainly can't fix the supply chain shocks. So it could get a lot worse. But on the flip side to that, it doesn't have to. If we were to see this contained in a relatively short space of time in the US and in Europe, then we could see, I think, potentially at this stage, the best case would be a U-shaped recovery, certainly not that V-shaped optimistic scenario, but we could see that U-shaped recovery coming through.
Saxo Capital Markets market strategist Eleanor Cray with David Taylor. You're listening to PM. We're on the radio, on the ABC Listen app, and you can subscribe to the PM podcast. I'm Linda Mottram. On Twitter, I'm at Linda Mottram. Ahead, the BBC, like many public broadcasters, it faces funding challenges. But what can it do about it?
The threat isn't just political, it also comes from technology. And if you have something called a television license fee that relies on people actually having something called a television, well, that's a problem.
Trying to respond to community outrage over last year's raids on journalists, the Department of Home Affairs has a new plan. It's proposed a new watchdog to help decide whether police should be allowed to conduct raids like the ones on the ABC and a News Corp journalist's home in 2019. We'll get a top barrister's view on that shortly, but here's political reporter Tom Eagledon in Canberra.
Three journalists are still facing potential criminal charges after two dramatic police raids last year. A public backlash is leading the government to think about a better way forward, and a clue about that thinking came today. The Department of Home Affairs is proposing what it's calling a notice to produce system, where police have to go to an independent watchdog before conducting raids on media organisations or their journalists. But the Minister of Home Affairs, Peter Dutton, is watching and waiting before giving the idea his blessing.
There is a new approach. I think there's been a lot of work to the Attorney's credit, to the Prime Minister's credit, to the credit of the Commissioner as well, to work with media organisations to try and find what is a sustainable common sense way forward. And I don't want to comment further in relation to submissions to the PJCIS or to other parts of that process, not just at the moment.
Is the government looking to adopt it as a policy?
Well, again, I just don't want to comment at this stage.
Right now, police already have to get a warrant for the sort of raids they conducted last year. The opposition's wondering how the Home Affairs Department's proposal would be any different. Shadow Attorney General Mark Dreyfus spoke to Friday Briefing on the ABC News Channel.
Saying that they're going to be independent issuing authorities is not a change from now, where you need to go to an independent authority to get a search warrant.
It's been 6 months since a parliamentary inquiry into press freedom was established to look into the raids. It suspended hearings 3 months ago while it waited for the Department of Home Affairs to come up with a proposal to better protect journalists. That, says Mark Dreyfus, now looks to have been a waste of the parliament's time.
This is the best that the government can come up with after 6 months. The government's clearly not serious about protecting the vital role that journalists play in our democracy.
And he says there's no suggestion the new proposal would have done much to stop last year's raids from going ahead.
They're saying police raids, yes, that can still happen. Charging of journalists, yes, that can still happen. They're not prepared to countenance what I say are very practical proposals that have been put forward by the Right to Know Coalition.
That's the campaign organised by multiple media organisations following the raids on the ABC's headquarters in Sydney last year and on the Canberra home of News Corp political correspondent Annika Smethurst. It's proposed what's called a contested warrant system like that which operates in the United Kingdom, where media organisations would get to argue their case before a warrant for a raid is issued. Home Affairs Department Assistant Secretary Hamish Hansford, appearing at an unrelated inquiry today, said the department's been busy working through that idea.
It took us some time to work with the Australian Federal Police to explore what a contested warrant would look like. You pointed us, I think, in your questions at the Press Freedom Inquiry to the design of the UK regime. We looked in depth at the UK regime.
And it appears during that process, the new proposal for a new watchdog was created instead.
If the committee was minded to make a recommendation about a notice to produce regime, which is outlined in the submission as opposed to a contested warrant regime, what that would look like, the impact it might have on the Australian Federal Police, what are the policy considerations. Obviously, there was a range of discussions.
Home Affairs Department official Hamish Hansford, Tom Eagledon with that report. Well, a British court has decided not to allow Julian Assange, the WikiLeaks founder, to be able to sit with his lawyers in court rather than in a glass box inside the court. This is during a now adjourned hearing of a US attempt to extradite him. In court this week in London, Assange's lawyers have drawn attention to his poor health, and they say he can't properly consult with them or hear and participate properly in proceedings. Assange faces 17 charges of espionage in the US and could face 175 years in prison over hacked and leaked US documents on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Fiona McLeod SC is chair of the Accountability Roundtable and a former Labor candidate at the last election. She joined me earlier. Fiona McLeod, thank you for joining us once more. Before we get to the Assange extradition hearings, what's your view of the Home Affairs Department's suggestion that police could go to a new special committee if they want to raid journalists' homes?
Well, presumably the panel that they're suggesting would be independent, but it would still be part of the executive arrangements, so it wouldn't have the true independence of a court. It could provide another level of monitoring and advice to the AFP before they go off to seek their search warrant. And don't forget that the issuing of a search warrant doesn't have to meet a very high threshold. It exposes a person at the end of the warrant, which can include a journalist or a media organisation, to a compulsory search and seizure that has the risk of disclosing a confidential source. Which, and the context of this case, of course, was the ABC presentation of stories concerning allegations of ADF members involved in what is said to have been unlawful killings in Afghanistan. So you couldn't get a clearer case of a public interest in reporting and that's of potential crimes and possible war crimes committed by Australians overseas. The introduction of this panel might be useful, but it simply doesn't go far enough.
Now, on the case of Julian Assange, there are allegations that his treatment in British detention amounts to torture. What evidence is there of that that you know of?
Well, the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, who has last year called for Assange's release and extradition to the US to be blocked, has comprehensively looked at the nature of his detention and the political reasons behind his seeking asylum in the embassy for so long. He described that as arbitrary detention and the conditions being tantamount to torture for that reason. He's now held, of course, in Belmarsh Prison, and it's interesting to talk about his case in the context of these raids on publishers and journalists, because the extradition to the US concerns the publication of documents also clearly in the public interest, the revelations by WikiLeaks of illegal conduct targeting civilians and potential war crimes by US troops. So a very similar context.
Further on Assange's case, his lawyers have told us he's physically and mentally unwell. They say new drugs mean that he's falling asleep in court, it seems. How does a court decide on matters of ill health? Could this court decide to intervene over his treatment generally?
It is incumbent on the court and the judicial officer who is hearing Assange's case to ensure that there is fairness in the process. All judges know that, and that is a fundamental duty they have to accused who appear before them. His case has been adjourned, I understand. He was indicating to the judge he was having trouble hearing, trying to give instructions to his lawyers, and one solution that was offered was that he could sit in the body of the court handcuffed to a security guard. That's a situation that's unheard of in Victoria, and I suspect in many other parts of Australia. A person must be able to hear the proceedings against them, must be able to exchange information with their lawyers, and the court must accommodate that. And I understand she refused a request that occur, but I don't understand why she would do that when clearly an accused person has a right to give instructions to his lawyers.
So is it your view that the British legal system is operating as it should in the case of Assange's extradition proceedings and his detention?
Well, the grave concern is that there's a political aspect to this. In terms of the conduct of the trial itself, the judge will reach a view about whether the extradition to the US should be granted or not. In terms of the treatment of Julian Assange by US authorities and the protection of his rights as a publisher, then no, the system is failing.
Fiona McLeod, thank you very much for your time today.
My pleasure, Linda.
Fiona McLeod SC is chair of the Accountability Roundtable. A longer interview with her on the PM webpage. A few more details are out today about the federal government's strategy for cutting greenhouse gas emissions, and it's all about hydrogen, gas and lithium. They'll make us a world leader, Energy Minister Angus Taylor says, as he stays well away from the political poison that is a carbon price. Australia will take more details of its plan to the next round of the global climate talks in Glasgow later this year, but it's not likely to get a positive hearing internationally. Gavin Coote reports.
The government wants its plan for cutting greenhouse emissions to be driven by tech, not taxes. Energy Minister Angus Taylor's putting a little more meat on the bone.
So it's about how do we deploy technologies between now and 2050 to reduce emissions without imposing costs on the economy. That's the key. That's what this is all about.
In the most detail yet, he's identified hydrogen and lithium as some of the key pillars in the government's emissions reduction plan. It's in part a rebuttal to Labor's move to sign up to a target of net zero carbon emissions by 2050. And today it was announced the chief scientist, Alan Finkel, will lead the development of the technology investment roadmap. Some are buoyed by all the talk of technologies like lithium in a low carbon economy. Independent commodities analyst Peter Strachan is one of them.
Well, lithium is certainly a big part in the whole matrix. The lithium ion batteries, the technology continues to improve, and you'll notice that the new iPhones charge in about an hour, whereas previously they would take 4, 5, 6 hours to charge. So that chemistry is changing. The amount of energy that you can store in a certain volume of batteries also going up. So that's excellent for power tools, for mobile equipment, telecommunications, and more and more it's being used for power storage, like we've seen in South Australia with a 100 megawatt storage facility there. But it's not the only chemistry about.
Peter Strachan is less enthusiastic about the idea of hydrogen in the new energy mix, which was recently the focus of its own strategy as a potential major export.
The energy cost of manufacturing that hydrogen is way more than the actual energy that you get out of that hydrogen by either putting it through a fuel cell or by burning it and turning it into to water. So there are a lot of challenges ahead, but we have to really tackle it.
Given it is a non-renewable resource, do we risk going down the path, though, of depleting those resources and ending up in the same situation where we have with other types of minerals?
That's right. I mean, all the time we are using finite non-renewable resources to build photovoltaic cells, to build wind turbines, whatever. These bits of equipment for renewable energy production are all made with finite non-renewable ingredient.
The role of solar panels and wind turbines didn't rate a mention in Angus Taylor's speech. The federal government will release its technology roadmap ahead of the Glasgow Climate Conference coming up in November. It's there where global leaders will look at stepping up their commitments on the Paris Agreement in 2015. For a number of countries, including the United Kingdom, this includes a pledge to be carbon neutral by 2050. Kate Dooley is a University of Melbourne researcher on global environmental politics.
So that will be certainly a big focus in terms of looking at the most ambitious countries, the least ambitious, and how everybody's moving towards targets that actually would limit warming to safer levels.
So technology, not taxes, does that represent something that could be seen as quite ambitious on the global stage?
Probably not. I mean, what a lot of countries are putting forward, and in fact, one of the boldest policies yet is the European Green Deal. The Green Deal is focused on pretty basic things, really. The existing technologies that we already have, a large shift to renewables, regeneration of agriculture and forestry areas, so restoring forests, all these kinds of strategies can reduce emissions significantly and draw down carbon into land without relying on very specific technologies or great advancements in technology.
University of Melbourne Climate Research Fellow Kate Dooley, Gavin Coote, our reporter. Well, we discussed earlier the Home Affairs suggestion of a new committee to rule on police raids against journalists. It's just part of the global struggle to protect the media's right to keep governments honest. Well, in the UK, the battle between government and accountability journalism is even more overt. Ministers are boycotting traditional political interview programs. Top journalists were recently excluded from a government briefing on EU trade negotiations. And then there's the BBC. The Prime Minister Boris Johnson has dangled the prospect of weakening or scrapping its main funding source, the $7 billion television licence fee. John Williams is the Managing Director of Ireland's public broadcaster, RTE. He's a former world editor for the BBC and he sits on the board of the Committee to Protect Journalists. He joined me from Dublin.
Undoubtedly, the new Conservative government wants to send a message to the Conservative Party, but they're not stupid. They know that the BBC commands around 80% support of the British public, the same British public that elect governments. And so you would have to be a very odd politician to want to destroy an organisation that 80% of your voters actually support.
Boris Johnson is, a very powerful Prime Minister. If he did choose to take on the BBC and do something about the licence fee, what would be the impact?
Well, I think for the BBC and for other public broadcasters around the world, the threat isn't just political, it also comes from technology. And if you have something called a television licence fee that relies on people actually having something called a television, well, that's a problem. And so there is undoubtedly a moment in the United Kingdom, and here in Ireland indeed, where technology is posing as great a challenge as any sort of political discourse. And undoubtedly, the BBC is going to have to try to move to a different form of funding. Currently, the television licence fee, which also pays for radio and for digital, raises close to £4 billion a year. Well, that is just not sustainable going forward. The BBC's current charter has about another 8 years to run. But at the end of that period, it's questionable as to whether something called a television licence fee is going to be tenable.
And you mentioned the charter. That's also up for renegotiation during this term of Boris Johnson's government. What do you think we might see there?
I think the key issue for the BBC and for many public broadcasters is how actually they are funded. And currently, it's a somewhat unsatisfactory, opaque system around charter renewal, where for the last two occasions, essentially, the BBC's had a gun held to its head by the government. First, in around 2010, at the height of austerity, where the BBC was forced to take on the funding of the BBC World Service at a cost of £247 million a year, and most recently forced to take on funding the licence fees for the over-75s, which previously had been funded by the Department of Social Welfare. Now, in all of these things, they are negotiations. But the issue is that undoubtedly the government is going to want to look at, what it says is a flat rate regressive tax, nearly just shy of £160 a year. And they want to make it less of a burden. They also want to decriminalise it. Right now, if you fail to pay the licence fee, you can go to jail. And again, that is seen as something that is anathema in the 21st century.
So there is a real conversation, as you say, to be had about a TV licence fee. As you say, it's clearly anachronistic. What are the alternatives, do you think?
Well, in much of Europe, there is something called a universal media charge. So it goes on to something like the council tax or the rates or a utility bill. And, we should be clear that this crisis that faces broadcasters isn't only facing broadcasters. There is a crisis of journalism more generally. In my role sitting on the board of the Committee to Protect Journalists, every week there are newspapers around the world that are closing. And, we should also be clear that whether it's RTE or the BBC or the ABC, I firmly believe that what we do adds public value. But so do other organisations that contribute in the world of journalism. And there is no reason why something like a universal media charge couldn't also be used to support journalism more generally.
And you mentioned the enduring popularity of the BBC. We register similar numbers with the ABC in Australia. But at the end of the day, are British voters going to go out on a limb for the BBC if someone like Boris Johnson really chooses to take them on?
Well, the challenge for the BBC, for RT and the ABC, actually is that people think it is a public good. But for them, there is a difference between what it means to me and what it means to us. And particularly when that comes to younger audiences. The BBC, like many of us, is struggling to attract younger audiences who, frankly, don't watch television. They consume media on other devices. They're used to consuming media in different ways. And so, you know, the real challenge, I think, for all of us is to demonstrate the value that we bring to every individual rather than what we bring to this thing we call society.
John Williams, thank you very much for your time today.
Pleasure, Linda.
John Williams is the Managing Director of Ireland's public broadcaster RTE, their news service there. I'm Linda Mottram. That is PM for today. You can always find us at the ABC Listen app and wherever you get your podcasts. That's where you should subscribe and leave us a review too. AM and The World Today are also there, so subscribe to them and leave them a review as well. Talk to you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Stephen Stockwell.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
First it was 7-Eleven, then Pizza Hut and Domino's. Now Coles, Target and Woolworths have been caught out, or they've confessed to underpaying their workers, in some cases by hundreds of millions of dollars. And at some point you start to wonder, is anyone following the rules here?
Today, Australia's endemic wage theft crisis. How bad is it? And how do you fix it when it's baked into the economy? Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.